So, well, one, you're listening to Ask an Atheist live at Clay 1180 AM in Tacoma, and I feel it necessary to mention that because it's a normal episode. We're back.
Yay.
We're back live.
We're back live. We are in the studio, 253-584-1480. And just to show how live we are, on the way to the station, we were driving along I-5, and suddenly, and just for some reason, my legs got warm, and it's like, oh no, did I just pee myself? Oh no. And then you guys simultaneously started shouting letters at me. Just, O-E-Q-P-Z! And I'm like, oh, here it is, I'm finally stroking out.
I had just seen a vanity plate on some car with a lot of Jesus bumper stickers, and I wanted to know what it meant.
As had I. I thought some was maybe. I thought a vanity plate was perhaps a hymnrader or call sign.
Right. So
it's got to mean something.
So you guys are seeking meaning in random patterns. My legs are getting warm, and I'm driving along I-5. I'm like, well, there goes my brain.
It's time to take Sam to a home.
It's time for Sam to go live on a farm. So
at the very least, it's time for Sam to pull over.
Well, yeah. And I'm like, why are you guys shouting letters at me? And if I got more letters back, it's like, okay, yeah, it's time for me to pull over and have somebody else do the show.
But the good news is you didn't actually pee yourself.
No. Pants are dry. Yep. And you guys were actually shouting letters at me, which is nice. So, well, still confusing, but... And no, as far as I could tell, there was no pattern to those vanity plates. Again, Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. So last week we had a bit of a different episode. Thank you guys for... We've gotten a lot of good stuff on it, but it's not something we do every week. This week it's going to be a more standard show. We've got some great guests. It's live. Feel free to call in. And we should talk about Peggy's Challenge. Peggy's Challenge is... a challenge made by Peggy from Kent to help keep Ask an Atheist on the air. So
yes, basically our show costs money to be on live radio. It costs us essentially about $3 a minute.
Yeah.
So folks have been very kind in going to our website, askanatheist.tv, clicking the red button on the right side of the screen that says contribute to the show and helping us out.
Actually, it's yellow.
Is it yellow now?
It's a yellow button. It's always been a yellow button. The red button is for questions. The yellow button is for donations.
See, now I'm being confused. Letters, numbers.
Colors.
So who do we have to donate this week, Becky?
We have Jan from Sweden, who bought us an entire episode. Thank you so much for your contribution. So
shows from Jan. Thanks.
Yes. We also have Christina from Mead, Washington, and Bjorn from Hamburg, Germany.
Peggy from Kent, Washington, who this challenge is named after.
Indeed.
Alfredo from Saras, California, Eric from Everett, Washington, and Ronnie from Herning, Denmark.
Thank you very much. So, do we have our first guest? I don't know. So, actually, we are also in Best of Western Washington again this year, right? That's what we're up to right now?
Yes. Basically, King 5, which is the local NBC affiliate, does this contest every year called the Best of Western Washington. And basically what it is that you go to their website, we've linked to it on AskAnAtheist.tv, and you vote for your favorite, like, auto repair shop, favorite restaurant. These things are really, really popular in the fact that people who win these things get a short time appearance on local TV.
Yeah.
They get to put a plaque up, and these things do help business. They do draw attention to you, and you get a lot of exposure through the local NBC affiliate.
And we've been mentioning it on Facebook, and if everybody who had liked the post where we talk about voting on Facebook had voted, we would easily win this. So
yeah, that's the funny thing, is that we're up for Best Local Podcast. You don't have to be a Washington resident to vote. You don't have to do that much to do it. It takes like 30 seconds. You can log on instantly through Facebook or Twitter. Go to our website, askanatheist.tv. Please give us a vote for Best Local Podcast. This is a good thing for us and the movement.
All right, so joining us via the phone is Seattle-based skeptic and researcher of all things but Bigfoot, Matt Crowley. How you doing today? Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hey.
So, we were thinking a bit about Bigfoot. I guess, sum it up for us, what is Bigfoot? What is this legend that people are so drawn to?
Well, it started in 1958, because that's when the word was coined. There were foot tracks found in Northern California, and the term Bigfoot was applied to these tracks that were found, and that's when it started. The legend probably goes back further than that, at least to the early 20s when the term Sasquatch was employed. But we're talking about a giant bipedal hairy beast that is yet to produce a body, but people have anecdotal reports and other kinds of evidence keep pouring in.
So, well, we have this legend, we have this idea, but we've yet to produce a body. We don't have a lot of physical evidence to go on. We just have the anecdotal stuff. So why is it held on since the 20s or the 50s? What is it about Bigfoot that people find so fascinating?
Well, there is some physical evidence. In fact, that's where the big division occurs, because you do have two kinds. You do have anecdotal evidence, and you do have some physical evidence, things like particular casts and the Patterson film. What I was investigating specifically were claims that there were dermal ridges on some of these casts. If you look at the very best of the field, which would be the material produced by Grover Krantz and Jeff Meldrum, who each wrote popular books on the subject, they do discuss physical evidence. So in my opinion, that's really the only thing worth really thinking about and investigating, is the claims of physical evidence. Because as we both know, yes, anecdotal claims are fairly weak. If you can apply the same logic to the historical claims of mermaids or fairies. Well, people saw mermaids and fairies, and today we don't take them as seriously. So that's you're right. That's more of a cultural kind of a phenomenon, and but not a it doesn't entail claims of scientific evidence.
So when somebody brings this physical evidence, what kind of evidence are we talking about here, and how do we investigate it to see if it's on the up and up?
Well, there's all different kinds of evidence. People keep, even today, keep referring to the Patterson-Gimlin film, which is this many widely seen film shot in 1967. Jeff Meldrum devotes quite a bit of time to that in his book. In 2000, I think, 4 or 5, there was a book that came out by Greg Long entitled The Making of Bigfoot, in which he did a great deal of background investigation into the nature of Roger Patterson and found that he was, well, basically a con man, and really put a huge dent in the credibility of the Patterson-Gimlin film, although it's not proof. Greg Long claimed that he had proved it, but other skeptics like Daniel Loxton and Michael Dennett said, well, not really. It didn't really prove that it's a hoax. It's the evidence piles up. But so the answer to your question is, in that case, it's more of an historical investigation. So each kind of evidence entails its own kind of investigation.
So you would say that the circumstantial evidence is that this was definitely a hoax, but there's no actually proof, say, in the film itself suggesting...
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
That's interesting.
It seems like hoax is something that we have come up a lot. I remember that there was a case a few years ago where somebody claimed to have produced a body, and then it turned out that it was like a rubber monster mask.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, the so-called Georgia Boys. Yes, indeed. Yes, that was quite surprising. If you go to Google, I think it's Google Analytics, and you just type in the term Bigfoot, there's this gigantic spike that occurs, which is a measure of how many the search results come up for the word Bigfoot. There's a gigantic spike right in about 2008 when that occurred. It's because it got a great deal of mainstream attention. And kind of the ground zero for that was a blog called Crypto Mundo, and this cryptozoologist named Lauren Coleman initially came out and said, well, I think it's the real deal, because he was shown photographs of this, and it indeed was a costume in a freezer, and apparently he saw these photographs and pronounced it, oh, it's the real deal. And that's when the fascination really took off, and it eventually got on CNN, but as we all know, there was nothing to it in the end.
It seems like this is a little bit harmful to the credibility of these cryptozoologists who want to be taken seriously as scientists when they're willing to pronounce this stuff true just by looking at the photograph. Wouldn't somebody who's really interested say, I want to see this body? I mean, just for the sake of science, I mean, just why would somebody stop at the photograph?
The other thing there is the suspense in the whole frozen Bigfoot thing was that they basically just let it thaw out slowly over a period of days. Isn't that?
Yes.
Isn't that not the way to do that sort of thing?
Right. Well, they made tactical errors, too, and I was obliquely involved myself, because this guy produced a video. This guy, I think his name was, there was Whitten and Dyer, and one of them was a police officer, in fact. And this guy, Dyer, I think he was a police officer, claimed that he had a brother-in-law who was a PhD and produced a video, which he put on YouTube. And he said, well, this guy is a PhD in whatever, anthropology, and he's going to examine it. And so this guy, they show this guy getting off a plane, and the supposed PhD comes along and says, well, we're gonna take a look at it because we think it might be the missing link. Well, obviously, no PhD in any biological science uses a ridiculous term like missing link. So immediately I knew, well, this is a phony. This is fake. And I posted it on one of these Bigfoot forums, a different forum called Bigfoot Discussions. Another guy started doing some facial analysis and looking through the internet and found, well, this guy is a strong match for this guy's brother, right? And indeed it was. It turned out to be his brother. And they pulled down the video and, in fact, admitted that, well, yeah, we were lying about that. This was, in fact, a lie. So they're actually admitting that they were lying before the big reveal.
Right.
So the hoax, yes, indeed, they hoaxed it wrong. Patterson did everything really correctly. He made a whole lot of money off of it, and to this day, it's never been proved as a hoax. But these Georgia guys were fairly unsophisticated in how they conducted themselves.
I sort of wonder if the Georgia guys were doing it in order to show, I guess, their viral marketing prowess, that it was actually sort of a job application in that industry. I sort of walked away with that feeling of it. Is there any evidence for that, or were they just hoaxing us?
Not that I know of. One of these guys was, in fact, a police officer. And I always figured he's going to get a cubo, conduct unbecoming an officer. And in fact, he was. He was eventually fired from his job as a police officer for that reason. And so I have no explanation for their actions. I don't know the long-term outcome beyond this guy losing his job over that. The other guy, I think, was a tow truck driver, so I think he kind of came out of it okay.
Wow.
So when somebody comes to you with this piece of evidence, or this piece of evidence comes forward from these people, what do you look for to see that if it's credible or not? What do you see? What do you look for specifically to find out if it's a hoax?
Well, that's a huge question, because of course you have to think, well, what kind of evidence? I mean, I'm a beginner as far as photography goes, so I have no special skill looking at anything like that. But what I did a number of years ago was investigate claims that there were dermal ridges on a particular cast, and I spent probably about 18 months doing test casts trying to understand what was going on, and eventually I came to the conclusion that this key piece of evidence, there was a fingerprint examiner from Texas named Jimmy Chilcutt, who claimed on television that he would stake his reputation on his analysis of a particular cast made in 1967 contained dermal ridges. He said, in fact, I'll stake my reputation on it. And so I thought, well, that's amazing evidence. And I came to a different conclusion, that these textures were a result of water flowing from the hardening plaster to the surrounding soil substrate. And I feel my case is fairly strong. In fact, one of the primary Bigfoot proponents, Jeff Meldrum, in fact, even publicly agreed with me, which is a very surprising turn of events. So the answer to that is, you have to tailor your investigation to whatever kind of evidence it is.
Right.
Some cases it's historical investigation, say like Ben Radford has done with the Chupacabra. And other times you'd need to have a background in photography or a background in plaster casting.
That's a very important point, that to be a skeptic in a certain field isn't just standing there in a room and saying, no, you're wrong, is that there's actually a set of tools that need to be applied. In your case, you were looking at how casts were made and how these ridges may have... And these dermal ridges, these are basically fingerprints but on feet, right?
Correct.
Okay, well, that's what the suggestion was. But what you're saying is that it's an effect of water flowing into the cast while it's drying?
Water flowing from in a particular cast, in one particular key piece of evidence. That's what I came to the conclusion. But I completely agree with you that, yes, and it frustrates me to read on the internet, because there is some truth to the accusation of armchair skeptic,
right?
Where a person analysis of concepts is a totally valid thing. I mean, if you look at David Hume and his the way he looked at miracles is pure armchair investigation. However, that only takes you so far. An excellent example of real-world investigation is, in fact, Ben Radford's investigation of the Chupacabra phenomenon. He literally went down to Central America, literally looking for the Chupacabra. And his investigation covered many kinds of areas. And so, yes, I am frustrated when I see people shouting and screaming on the Internet, because that's not where the heavy lifting that is required really needs to occur.
Yeah, sort of the difference between being skeptical and being a skeptic.
Yeah, I've noticed something, Matt, is that the History Channel over the past couple of years has gotten, let's say, a reputation for doing programs about, like, UFOs and werewolves. Have we seen a resurgence in Bigfoot popularity because of this kind of programming?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the Internet is part of it. Because the Internet provides an immediate kind of feedback. You know, I'm of an age, and friends of mine who are similarly interested in Bigfoot almost all have the same kind of a story arc. At some point in time in the early 70s, they saw the Patterson film on a television show, and maybe they had one of John Green's early books, and it was totally infrequent. There was no way that you could learn more about this esoteric subject, because it's not like you're going to find an entry on it in the Encyclopedia Britannica in the mid-70s, right?
Right.
Now, because of the Internet, you can interact with other people with a similar esoteric interest. But yes, television, there seems to be a resurgence, in my opinion, a significant resurgence in television. Even in the last 10 years, there have been a number of Monster Quest was on for several years, and obviously Finding Bigfoot is very popular. And Finding Bigfoot appears to be this, I have only watched little bits of it, but it appears to be the same general template as these ghost finding type of episodes where
right.
You go out with night vision and this and that, and your expeditions are very hokey, and everyone mocks you, and they never find anything.
Well, in recent years, we've noticed a sort of a turn for the weird, like symposia on Bigfoot that suggest, you know, where the big question to be answered at this convention is whether or not Bigfoot is an alien dimensional traveler who can move
right.
in dimensional space.
Correct.
Rather than just a large ape man living in the woods, we're starting to see cryptozoologists connect Bigfoot to UFOs and stuff like that.
Right.
Have you encountered these claims, and what is that like?
Well, I did encounter a guy named Eric Bechtard at a Bigfoot conference in Idaho shortly before he died. He was one of the primary proponents of that way of thinking, but he was not befriended very well within the Bigfoot community. And it actually, if you look at the Bigfootery as a cultural phenomenon,
Bigfootery,
you will see that from the late 60s, there was the word was put down by John Green. He said, you know, this subject is fringe as it is, and it doesn't help your cause to explain one mystery with another mystery. And that makes very good sense to me. If you say, well, it's an interdimensional creature, that only pushes the mystery back one degree, kind of like pushing the cause argument in the God question back one degree. And so that he was right. And so from there, it came down for many years that there was a kind of this schism that, well, there was the so-called flesh and blood Bigfooters who said, well, look, it's not helping our cause to associate ourselves with UFOs or ghosts or a paranormal phenomenon. We've got to look at this as a biological thing. And if you look at the primary guy today, Jeff Meldrum, he's certainly one of these flesh and blood Bigfoot proponents. But you are correct. There's always been this undercurrent, and it's always been at odds with the flesh and blood guys. They kind of have their own conferences. They're often shunned on Internet discussions. So there is a schism there.
Yeah. Where do you think this stuff is ultimately coming from? Where do you think it's going? I mean, what is the end point of Bigfoot is a dimensional traveler, you think?
Personally, I think that we're going to see a decline in the television. I think that it's a fad that's going to run out. It's just like any other fad of television. However, it's going to stay popular on the Internet. And I think that it's a self-perpetuating phenomenon because either there is or is not an animal in the woods. Okay, if regardless of the answer to that question, people keep reporting seeing things, so that's going to keep perpetuating. They're also, it's fairly easy to fabricate tracks in the woods or wherever, and so I think people are going to continue fabricating tracks.
Right. You know,
just this last week, there was a set of tracks found in Western Washington. And some of these Bigfoot guys, oh, this is amazing. They're proclaiming them very excellent, high-quality evidence. And so I think that that's going to keep perpetuating. So I see no end to it.
Okay. So, Matt, if people would like to follow up with you online and learn about what you're doing, where would they go to find you?
Well, let's see. Probably Twitter. Matt the Tube at Twitter. My website is called Orgone. O-R-G-O-N-E, research. A parody, of course, on Wilhelm Reich.
Yeah.
Unique Theories, Orgone Research. So I have a large, and there's an email address through that. But yeah, so that would be probably my website, and probably through Twitter. On Facebook, you can find me through Ben Radford's friends, perhaps.
All right, thank you very much. Matt Crowley is a Bigfootery skeptic and joined us today. So thank you very much.
Right on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. We're going to go into the break. When we come back, we're going to talk about that whole thing that happened in that other country.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
And how do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
Looking to sell or buy a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, and surrounding areas? Plant your roots and invest in this entrepreneur-friendly area with world-class education and healthcare. Demand a professional and call Dawn Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 and let him work with you to achieve your goals, save your time, and protect your investment. Contact Dawn Summers of Professional Realty Group at dndrealty.ca. It's time you hired a professional.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
So what does everybody want to play?
Something new?
Something with guns. Lots of guns.
Something that supports playing other than combat, you knob.
Jerk face.
All right, how about Dead Stars from Dame and I Publishing? It's a sci-fi game that uses the Universal Decay rules, a variation on our usual fantasy campaign system. This system has an emphasis on social and technical skills, yet allows technical characters to make thousands of different weapons.
Hey, psionics.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna be a bug with big freaking guns.
Shape-shifting tech head for me.
Check out DameandI.net for the sci-fi horror game Dead Stars, as well as a listing of other products and to get involved in the community forums.
This November in Washington State, we have an opportunity to strike a blow against religious privilege and become the first state to legalize marriage equality by a majority of voters.
Some people might be confused about why we're asking you to vote to approve Referendum 74. I mean, didn't the people opposed to equal rights get this on the ballot? Well, yeah, they did.
When the Washington State Legislature passed marriage equality earlier this year and Governor Gregoire signed it, the religious right challenged that law.
Now we are the legislature.
When you vote to approve Referendum 74, you are voting to approve the exact same bill the legislature passed.
We believe that real religious liberty means a secular government that respects diversity where no one's religious ideology is imposed on anyone through the force of law.
Vote to approve extending equality and respect to all Washington families. Vote to approve Referendum 74 this November 6th.
To help make it happen, donate to Washington United for Marriage through the Ask an Atheist team page.
Go to askanatheist.tv/r74.
We're the producers of Ask an Atheist.
And we pay for this ad.
On the 11th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, a mob of violent Islamist extremists stormed the American embassy in Benghazi, Libya, and set it on fire. Chris Stevens, the American ambassador who helped save the city during the last year's revolution, was murdered along with another diplomat and two State Department security officers. In the weeks that followed, the Muslim world has been rocked by protests and riots, many of them becoming violent. Many people have died. Cars have been set ablaze, and rocks have been hurled at U.S. embassies around the Middle East. And what are they responding to? Did the U.S. military bomb a mosque? Did the U.S. Congress pass a law that persecuted Muslims? Have Muslims been killed in a religiously motivated attack by Americans? No. An anonymous man in California, under the pseudonym of Sam Basile, made an amateurish, low-budget movie that insulted the Muslim prophet Muhammad. That's all. According to the Associated Press, 49 people are now dead and nearly 200 are injured because a man made a glorified YouTube video, 4chan quality, with bad special effects, floating in a green screen, and terribly dubbed dialogue. Wow. Blasphemy is illegal in the largely theocratic Muslim world, and the punishment for it can range from imprisonment to death. Even a great many of the peaceful protesters who are not engaging in violence or have condemned the violence are still calling for the prosecution of the filmmaker on blasphemy charges. And they aren't alone. A number of well-meaning and progressive people in the United States and Europe have joined that chorus and are putting the blame for the violence and those murders at the feet of the filmmakers, not the Muslim extremists that perpetrated it. Andrew Brown in the UK Guardian called for the movie to be banned. Anthea Butler, an associate professor of religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania, called for Sam Basile to be jailed in an article in USA Today. MSNBC hosts Mike Barnicle and Donnie Deutsch opine that the Justice Department should prosecute the filmmakers and those involved in the film as accessories to the murder of the ambassador. Many other progressive voices, some even in the atheist community, have joined in morally equating the act of hurting one's religious feelings with murder. And that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, this is heavy stuff, and this is something that really motivates us on why we have a show in the first place, because our point of view is not being aired out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe this really, more than anything, puts an exclamation point on what the loss of Hitchens has meant for this community.
I know. And, you know, I said 4chan quality, and I'm gonna totally back away from that statement, because I remember the Project Chanology stuff. I remember the videos they did. That was way better quality than this. This was junk. There was this. I mean, just to start, that this was the ultimate in troll videos. It was made. The whole movie was made in front of a green screen, probably in the back of a dry cleaners or something like that. And you know, it looks like all of the actors are hovering over the sets, and they've got terrible spray tans. And every mention of religion and every mention of Muhammad is an ADR, is a terrible dub, because they didn't want people to know, or they didn't want the actors to know, that they were basically in an anti-Muslim propaganda film. It's terrible, and as a result, people are dead.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say as a result of the movie, because you know what? People have a choice when every time you provoked.
It is a result of the movie, but it is not... This is the equation, is that some guy made this movie and some violent, you know, extremists use this as a casus belli to attack somebody who's actually doing some good on behalf of the U.S. in the Muslim world.
One of the things is that it's since come out that the case in Libya is actually more likely to be a case of using this film as a cover for coordinated attacks. But that's not the case in Sudan, in Syria, in Pakistan, where the sort of demonstrations and the destructive and violent protests are sourced at this video because of this video.
Yeah, the thing that I find really, really offensive about this is not necessarily the people in the streets who are largely brainwashed growing up in theocracies. It's the people who are educated, who are grown up in a Western government, who are progressive, who are well-meaning, who are basically saying the exact same things as these leaders in theocratic countries, yeah, saying that we need to throw these people in prison, that we need to throw these filmmakers. The last thing they want to talk about is the violence. The last thing they want to talk about is 49 dead people, over 200 people who've been injured,
yeah,
talking about restaurants and movie theaters have been set ablaze. They don't want to talk about this. And we're talking about good, progressive people who we would agree with on a large, large scale of issues.
Yeah.
But they just don't want to talk about the violence. Because if this was Pat Robertson, if Pat Robertson had gotten a mob together because somebody had made a YouTube video making fun of Jesus, the exact same, you know, fake offense, blasphemy.
Yeah.
And had gotten a bunch of people together, and they'd killed maybe the ambassador of the country that that had gotten made in. Or they had set a couple buildings afire. Or they were in the streets calling for this man to be jailed. Pat Robertson would be in prison right now.
In America, everybody's favorite Christian troll is Fred Phelps. Is Fred Phelps in prison? Do people think that Fred Phelps should be thrown in prison? There's a small community of people who do. But the fact of the matter is nobody's calling for his imprisonment. Nobody's calling for him being charged under blasphemy laws or incitement to riot or anything like that. And you know why? Because nobody has murdered anybody because he's an idiot. But just because somebody unrelated took it too far, whether or not that was the intent is irrelevant. This anonymous guy in California didn't murder anybody. You know, and I think there's something that I need to say, which is I think sometimes there's a difference between social responsibility and legal culpability. This guy was a troll. These things that happened in Benghazi, these things that are happening across the Middle East, is this what he wanted? Of course. Does that make him a nice guy? No. He's a terrible human being. I don't like him. I'm not going to stand with him. Does he deserve to be thrown in jail on blasphemy laws or for incitement to riot because he did a YouTube video? If so, I'm going to jail right along with him because I do this show. So, no.
Yeah. I mean, we're at the point here where we're talking about there's an offensive movie on the internet. Well, you know what? Welcome to the internet in the 21st century, Islam. Welcome to seeing things that us as non-believers put up with every day. We've seen billboards saying, why do atheists hate America? Why is it that we don't see people in the streets calling for those people who made those billboards to be jailed?
Yeah.
Why is it that we don't see people attacked every time you put up a video from like a Thunderfoot or whatever on YouTube insulting a religion? You know why? Because religion in the Western world has gone through a centuries-long painful process of being dragged, kicking, and screaming into modernity, and that means a secular country. We stopped a long time ago giving religion, especially Christianity in this case, the right to jail people who dissent, the right to beat people or threaten them into silence. I mean, clearly some of them have not gotten the memo.
I wouldn't call our record on that perfect. The thing about moving to a secular society, it's still a process which is underway. We're still working on it. We still make mistakes. There are still parts of the United States that, for all intents and purposes, is still a Christian state or a Christian county, just because nobody's been there to challenge them yet. And that's just, it's the overwhelming social pressure. We have these problems too in America. You know, in America, in the Western world, we have our own challenges.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying that. Every week on this show, we talk about some Christian group trying to force itself on there.
Yeah.
And we do have Christian violent groups, which is another thing that a lot of people on the right don't want to accept.
Right.
Is that there are groups like the Hutari,
right,
which was a Christian terrorist group. Or you want to look at what Christianity looks like in an environment where restrictions are not put on it legally? Look at Uganda.
Right.
In Uganda, we have pastors actually pushing laws that are calling for the death of people for the crime of homosexuality. Or in much of sub-Saharan Africa, you have Christian witch hunters pouring acid on children because they're crying too much, and clearly that's a sign that they've been possessed by the devil. And this goes back to my goldfish theory of religion.
Yeah.
Religion is like a goldfish. It will grow to fit the bowl you get it. And religion is defined by the restrictions legally that you put on it. That a goldfish is not going to get too big when you have something like the separation of church and state, like protections that go even further than that, and a number of our states saying we're not going to give state funds to religion, saying that no, your Christian mob, no matter how badly your feelings have gotten hurt, we're not going to make it against the law to hurt your feelings. And you look at, say, the Muslim world, and like Uganda too, the church is the state. So
absolutely.
People so used to having this privileged position where they can kill somebody or threaten to kill somebody or pass a law and jail somebody because they hurt their religious feelings. I'd say welcome to the 21st century, Islam. Grow up.
You know, Mike, something about your goldfish theory of religion really struck me. The other thing that goldfish are known for, besides growing to fit their container, is for a 10-second memory. I think that's something also, maybe perhaps unintentionally salient on your part, that perhaps we're missing the, sort of the memory of when this has happened to us in other instances throughout history.
It's absolutely amazing that the thing that really kicks me, the thing that really, okay, obviously the violence is terrible. It bothers me that this violence happens because somebody makes a troll video on YouTube. But it also bothers me that even middle-of-the-road, non-extremist Muslims and Christians are now calling for an international blasphemy law in the UN. And this is just incredibly out of hand. A blasphemy law? Does that mean everything I do? Everything I do with Ask an Atheist is now against the law?
What's really interesting here is that I first saw this on a Spanish language news outlet about a Palestinian leader saying we should petition the UN for a blasphemy law. And then someone else came forward saying, oh, look, this is someone in Libya saying there should be an international blasphemy law for the UN. And then, Mike, you came up with the most recent addition to this, and it is the Prime Minister of Pakistan who is calling for such things.
Absolutely. And I think it comes down to this thing for me. The people in these countries, they're not animals. They're not children. We're talking about adult human beings. And they're going to have to learn to be offended in constructive ways. Like I said, atheists are constantly accused of being behind school shootings or saying we're incapable of morality. We're not marching in the streets demanding that the people who say this stuff go to jail. Why? Because we have to live in a pluralistic society. We have to learn how to find constructive ways to respond, and so does Islam.
So joining us right now is Sean Faircloth, Director of Strategy and Policy for the Richard Dawkins Foundation and author of Attack of the Theocrats. So, Sean, can you give us your thoughts on the blasphemy protests over this video?
Yeah, one way I'd ask people to look at it is if, say, we went tabula rasa, wiped the slate clean, and said, here in the United States, there was a Muslim group that had successfully said that it's going to teach in taxpayer-funded public schools things like women shall be inferior, allow for more severe corporal punishment for children, exempt themselves from land use planning law. Unfortunately, I think you might see some interestingly predictable, but in some ways counterintuitive results. You might see right-wing Christians be up in arms saying, let's stop this. And then, oddly enough, you might see liberal folks or folks we perceive as liberal saying, well, but that's their culture and that's okay. What's ironic is that situation on the books, sometimes with government money, in American law, there is authorization with the exemption to Title IX to teach females, women and girls that they are inferior, and that is often practiced in Christian schools in this country. And my sense is that people who are on the fundamentalist side of the dial would be up in arms if a Muslim organization were to do this. And then we have this strange and interesting phenomenon where progressives tend to be very protective about other religions. They want to be politically correct and say, well, it's not really the religion, so we have to defer to their culture. I would hope that we would have one standard, and that standard would apply whether it's fundamentalist Christianity or fundamentalist Islam. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that.
I absolutely agree with you. In the southern part of the country, there have been clearly dominionist laws passed about education, and then the legislators, when they discover that these laws equally count for Muslim education as they do Christian education, they go, wait, that's not what I meant. Do over.
I think that was the case in Louisiana's voucher system.
Yes.
Exactly, and one of the laws that I like to point out at the federal level, because it's so little known, we celebrated the 40th anniversary of Title IX, which provided for gender equity. Usually you hear that discussed over these last 40 years in the context of women's sports and all of the controversies you see there. But what people sometimes forget is that law was actually designed and more primarily focused, in fact, on typical academics. And yet, in that law, always has been, there's an exemption in the law for religious organizations that can say if it's part of the tenet of our religion. And in the United States, that's overwhelmingly that exception has been utilized by fundamentalist Christians. And once we were to know, oh, yeah, it's fundamentalist Christians that are doing that, then you'd see the tables reversed, and you'd see progressives saying, well, that seems wrong, and you'd see fundamentalist Christians jumping over to say, hey, that's our right, that's our community, that's our culture, you shouldn't interfere. Whereas what I think is noble and appropriate for us, for secular people, is to openly state that we believe the standard should apply equally as to all religious bias in law, and certainly, of course, as your initial question indicates, with regard to blasphemy laws, which are, pretty it up as you like, restrictions on conscience and restrictions on speech.
Has there been an official response from the Richard Dawkins Foundation on this yet, or are just handling it individually?
Well, I know that Richard Dawkins, if you mean this being the issue of the explosion in the Mideast over the video and so forth, I know he's written about this topic himself. I also gave a speech recently in Washington State that pertained to this topic. Ironically, I had planned the speech before the explosions over the video, but really it pertains, because my speech was focused on the foreign policy of the United States, and there are many commendable things, I must say, about actually under both Obama and Bush about protecting, certainly, religious freedom, and I would be one to support that as well in terms of nonviolent religious freedom, but also in terms of the protection of the minority rights of people of conscience who are atheist, humanist, and secular. And the United States government, while it has done some good things, has not been as bold as I think would be justified by our Constitution and by the values of Jefferson and Madison in terms of speaking out about the number of times where secular people in the Middle East, for example, in Muslim nations, for example, speak out for human rights, for conscience, often for women's rights, including one prominent case of a gentleman in Saudi Arabia speaking out for women's rights, and being subject to potentially sanctions that include death for doing the right thing. And I want to see the United States government, our State Department, our President, our Secretary of State, speaking out more boldly about these issues. And that viewpoint predates what's happened in the Middle East with regard to this inane video.
Absolutely.
But the video underscores it.
Sean, go ahead and stick. If you can stay on the line with us, we need to go to a break. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. We'll be back in a second.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
And how do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
Looking to sell or buy a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, and surrounding areas? Plant your roots and invest in this entrepreneur-friendly area with world-class education and healthcare. Demand a professional and call Dawn Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 and let him work with you to achieve your goals, save your time, and protect your investment. Contact Dawn Summers of Professional Realty Group at dndrealty.ca. It's time you hired a professional.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
So what does everybody want to play?
Something new?
Something with guns. Lots of guns.
Something that supports playing other than combat, you knob.
Jerk face.
All right, how about Dead Stars from Dame and I Publishing? It's a sci-fi game that uses the Universal Decay rules, a variation on our usual fantasy campaign system. This system has an emphasis on social and technical skills, yet allows technical characters to make thousands of different weapons.
Hey, psionics.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna be a bug with big freaking guns.
Shape-shifting tech head for me.
Check out DameandI.net for the sci-fi horror game Dead Stars, as well as a listing of other products and to get involved in the community forums.
This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. So, Sean, before we get on to our other subjects, you have a upcoming dinner this next month, right?
Say dinner?
Yeah, at the FFRF conference?
Right. In the Northwest, we're actually doing a whole series of private fundraising events where Richard Dawkins will be present, including in Portland. And I encourage people, it's the Saturday of the FFRF convention in Portland, Oregon, to come. It is a fundraiser. It supports the projects of the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, which really requires a lot of activism
and it requires funding to really implement that activism. And we're asking folks to participate, but it will be very fun and an opportunity, because oftentimes when people, if they do get the chance to see Richard Dawkins, it's in a crowd of 1,000 people or something like that, which is right. Great. But this would be an opportunity to invest in our organizational efforts, and also get a chance where you're, you know, at a cocktail reception and really get a chance to have a conversation with him as well. So I encourage people to check that out. You can go to richarddawkins.net and get further details.
And we'll include notes, directions and notes and a link on the show notes for that upcoming dinner fundraiser. So a few weeks ago, we saw the Democratic National Convention buckle to pressure from the right and some party leaders to inject a lot of exclusionary language about God into what had been a secular platform. Can you give us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it was a very revealing moment. I think it was the one 10-year moment of that convention. I have to say, you know, I was 10 years in politics, and I sort of come to the secular world from the activist world of the Democratic Party. That was my history before this. And so it is revealing to me because of who's in that room. When you heard, as I'm sure you know, there were people who booed that result, who said no and shouted against it.
It hardly seemed unanimous, yeah.
Yeah, oh, there were people adamantly speaking out for a secular perspective and being very vocal. Interesting, because one, the behind-the-scenes word is that it was the president himself who was pushing for this. And so these people were willing to speak out in a very verbal way, and this, to me, is a very telling opportunity. Obviously, I'm disappointed because I feel like the Democratic Party's convention, which otherwise was a rather impressive convention, I have to say, some of the best speaking performances I've seen in one convention in a long time. But that was the wrong note, if you will, because what really happened, and forget about from a secular perspective, just from a pragmatic political perspective, if I were to bet, I bet Obama's going to win this election, but I don't think that helped, because what happened? The right gets to attack and do ads and say, hey, look, they're booing, and they're not going to give any credit for being so-called religious. Meanwhile, it disappoints people like those who are shouting no, who say, we actually believe in the founding principles of this country and really honor those, and they feel disappointed and somewhat betrayed by that. So I don't think it really accomplished their political end. It was the only detracting note, I'd say, in fact, from the convention. But frankly, the incident to me gives me great optimism, and here's why. These people who are shouting no, these are not secular activists. They probably... They may not even have heard of TAM. They might have not even heard of the American Humanist Association or what have you. But there they are speaking out, and that, to me, is fertile ground. I believe that if we organize, we in the secular community, organize strategically, which is what my book is really about, that there is very fertile ground to really bring forth a much broader activist movement for secular values.
I do wonder how much of this is, I love that, and I think that's, I mean, now is a good time, now is the time, I think the Atheist Visibility Movement is now starting to have an effect, but I do wonder, because there was another thing on that platform, which was Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. How much of it do you think was the First Amendment protection of religion, and how much of it was, do you think, a perceived shift in Democratic policy on Israel?
I think it was certainly a combination of both, and they're going to be worried about their base within Jewish voters and all those pragmatic factors. But nonetheless, I think that there is a fairly vocal group of folks who feel like this pandering is upsetting to them. And what, frankly, I think the deficit has been among secular activists is that we had this tremendous surge, at least that's how I see it, not to borrow that term from, our military policy. But we have this tremendous surge, if you will, with the Dawkins book, with the Hitchens book. Those books really changed the game, Sam Harris book. And that was really a believe or not believe, yes or no type of debate. And obviously, I think on the merits, our side prevailed when you discuss the merits. And for millions upon millions of people, I think it was a significant moment. I mean, I can't tell you, being the opening act, if you will, for Richard Dawkins, how many times I've seen people come up to him and say, your book changed my life, and they mean it. You know, yeah. A lot of people. But now I think it's time for the next stage. And to me, the next stage is saying we are going to have this impact, a real solid impact on the American civic life. And we have really yet to penetrate there in a major way. And that's what I'm writing about in my book, is how do we take those pragmatic steps so that, say, by the next Democratic convention, I think this is a real possibility if we do it right, that by the next Democratic convention, you'll have people who are saying, no, I am adamant about this, and are really coming prepared to speak out, not just on, I don't want to say symbolic issues, but on those issues, but to really come out and say, look at all these laws that exist today in America where there's a privilege of religion. You know, when you were talking earlier about, you know, the issue with Islam, the fact is, often unknown to even secular and liberal religious people, is how many religiously biased laws there already are in America to the favor of the religious right. And we need to expose it and enlist people to support our side.
So I know this is your this is what your book is about. So I don't want you to tell us what you know, tell us what's in your book. But what can the atheist visibility movement do between now and 2016 to sort of achieve those goals that you're talking about? Like what are some of the things that we could start doing now?
Right, there are many things I'll talk about in the book, but let me just cherry pick a couple that I think are most important. Really, above all else, is like, as I understand you folks are working on in Washington State, is having some kind of secular statewide group that it doesn't have to meet every day. In fact, for me, I'd be happy if there was a convention once every other year, but every year would be even better. And let me explain why I think that gets to this issue of the 26 conventions and so forth.
So, Sean, I'm sorry, Sean. I know that we have a position now as atheists where we got our first mention from the president in his inaugural address, that just to mention that we exist. But how far do you think that we are away from atheists actually becoming a respected constituency that politicians don't just acknowledge exists but actively try to court?
I think we could get there with some initial serious glimmerings by 2016, and I think by 2020, if we do things right, we could be a significant force in American political life. But it requires something that, frankly, we haven't done before. A lot of times I go to these meetings, and everybody comes up with the cliche, oh, herding cats, and throws up their hands and says, well, that's just how we are. And I'm saying, hell no, let's get up off our couches, not just watch the videos and say, oh, I agree, and isn't that wonderful? No, so we're going to organize. So let's just take, it could be any state, but let's just take Washington State as an example, which to me is an important state, because you actually have some politicians there who might listen now. I mean, there's some real hope there. And that, however, needs to be supported by an activist organization that looks truly credible. And what do I mean by credible? I mean you've got a significant email list that you can go to into a politician's office and say, this is a wonderful meeting, and have your 10 to 15 people show up at an office meeting with a member of Congress or U.S. Senator, have them there, talk about religious bias and law, and then say, we're so pleased to be here. We're going to email 10 or 15 or 20,000 people tomorrow and say how pleased we were with this meeting. That's when politicians start to pay attention, that and money.
Yeah.
And frankly, right now, we haven't done that as well. And that's where this convention, like where I want to see, you know, an evergreen or, you know, Washington State kind of convention every other year, is that means you have officers who are working statewide. We're saying we're including Spokane. We're including the Tri-Cities area. We're including Seattle. We're reaching out, and we're getting to build a stable of speakers. So it's not just your national, your Richard Dawkins-type speakers who come every once in a while to whatever state, that you start building a stable of secular expertise, you know, a professor from Washington State or from University of Washington or whatever the case may be, who can talk about these issues locally, and then they bubble up. That's how the ACLU did it 50 years ago, and I think that is so essential to what we need to do. So it's the base first, and then start saying, who's going to run, not for president, who's going to run for city council, who's going to run for school board, who's going to run for state legislature?
So I, you know, we went to see you speak in Kennewick just last week while we were doing the Camp Quest episode, and somebody actually stood up and said, you know, haha, we're, you know, it's like herding cats. You did exactly what you said. That actually happened at a speech you gave just last week, and I happened to be right. I happened to be there, and I got up and I said, we may be like herding cats, but with our referendum 74 problem, when we see a problem, when there are things that happen, we stop becoming cats, and we become a real, like almost a machine. We work very hard. We work, you know, there's a tactical concept going on. We're actually pretty good at this, and I think we forget that sometimes.
Right, and I think you put your finger on it there with the issue of having a specific cause.
Yeah.
Because when it's, say, equal rights for gay people or women's reproductive rights, which I would call the two obvious sound, I don't mean to say obvious in a pejorative way, but they're the two issues that most people, if you went and asked at the mall, would say, oh, yeah, that does have to do with church and state. I get that. I know that that's an issue. Whereas in the 10-point vision of a secular America that I write about in my book, the whole strategy of that is to say, you didn't know about the children's laws where there's privilege of religion. Maybe you didn't know about the land use planning laws where there's privileging of religion. And I think that accomplishes a couple things. It hits sort of unexpected notes on the keyboard where people go, oh, really? I didn't even know about that. Even me, a liberal person or a secular person, I didn't know about that issue. And isn't that terrible? And it gives people a cause to motivate on. And it's a cause that's distinctive. Because one challenge I think we have, although we should, I believe, be very supportive of, say, equal rights for gay people, is that there's what I call, you know, an aircraft carrier. The Human Rights Campaign in Washington, D.C., there are some major, major institutions working that issue. Whereas if we add these additional issues, we can be the leading voice and the distinctive voice where people have to say, oh, that's right about these children, and we're the lead voice speaking on that topic.
Sean,
and I think that can gain us traction.
Sean Faircloth is the Director of Strategy and Policy for the Richard Dawkins Foundation, and your book, Attack of the Theocrats, is coming out in paperback very soon. Thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Wow, that's a pretty busy episode today. So, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I really think it's necessary for us to stand up for free speech. I don't understand why this is even a debate.
Yeah, so that's all the time we've got for today. My name is Sam. With me was Mike Gillis and Rebecca Friedman. Our special guests were Matt Crowley and Sean Faircloth. Music, by, as usual, is by Chris Coleman. Our production assistants are Eileen Cavallo and Steve Jones. Post-show is at Doyle's is an hour. Ask an Atheist is an NEDM media production. You can email us at questions@askanatheist.tv or leave us a voicemail at 206-420-0997. See you guys next week.
Clay Radio, your conversation station. KLAY Lakewood, Tacoma, on 1180 AM.